Robert Zubrin with us. We're going to take phone calls as we talk about Mars. Many more questions, and I'm sure you've got a few too, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Robert Zubrin with us. We're going to get to your calls as well as we're talking about space and Mars specifically this hour. Robert, as we look at things that are happening on Mars, remember there was a movie that came out with Matt Damon called The Martian. Did you have a chance to see that one?
Yes, I did.
Can we survive like that on Mars realistically, like he did?
Well, kind of. That movie was the first movie that attempted to depict an expedition to Mars realistically. That is, you know, previous to that, we had things like Total Recall and stuff, which basically are shoot-em-ups or horror pictures or something. This one attempted to deal with it with a certain amount of realism. You know, the windstorm was not realistic. The wind would not be that strong on Mars because the air is so thin. But, I mean, there was a scene where he doesn't have his helmet on, I think, or something like that for a second, or I forget exactly. And some of that is a little out there. But basically, the answer is yes. That is, you have the stuff on Mars that is needed for life and for technology. You could grow food on Mars. There is water. There is carbon dioxide. There is enough sunlight to grow plants. And while trying to do it in a Robinson Crusoe way, it probably wouldn't work. A team of people there with the right tools could probably do it.
I had heard that prolonged space hurts the astronauts. What do we do about that?
Okay, well, there are two effects that people talk about. There's the radiation effects, and there's the zero gravity effects. And the radiation effects get the most talk. And, for instance, this guy published a study a month ago in which he said that radiation will cause, that space radiation, the cosmic rays will cause brain damage and so forth. And he attempted to prove this by irradiating mice. But what he did was he exposed them to a radiation dose at 40,000 times the rate that the astronauts would get in space. So it was not a realistic study at all. It was crazy. I mean, if you know, that'd be like saying that apples kill you because if you ate 40,000 apples in a single night, you'd die. Okay. So, but apples are not poisonous. They're just poisonous if you try to eat 40,000 of them in one night. You know, I mean, there's
same with water. You drink a lot of water, you're going to get sick.
Yeah, if you drank that much water, and certainly if you had, you know, I mean, in other words, look, you could have one martini a night for a year, and you'd do just fine. If you had 365 in one night, you would die.
So
the rate at which radiation is received, it matters a lot. And so that study was a fake study, and it's nonsense. And in fact, we've had a dozen astronauts and cosmonauts who've taken radiation doses on the space station or its predecessor, the Mir, that are comparable to what they would get going to Mars and back, and there have been no radiological casualties at all. Okay, now it does increase your risk of cancer by about 1% to go to Mars and back, but if you consider that a smoking habit increases it by 20%, then you can put that in perspective. There's a lot of things that people do that are more dangerous than the radiation dose on the way to Mars and back. Now, the zero gravity, on the other hand, does have measurable effects. It weakens the bones, it weakens the muscles, it can also cause fluids to move around in the body and put pressure on the eyes and blur the eyesight. This is not good, but there's a way around that, which is if you rotate the spacecraft, you can create, using centrifugal force, artificial gravity, and all these effects go away. So this endless fascination with zero gravity health effects has to do with the control of the NASA Space Medicine Program by zero-gravity health effects researchers. And they are adverse to artificial gravity because it solves a problem they need to have. But, you know, provided that we provide the crew with artificial gravity, we won't have these effects. Now, furthermore, the effects that you do have, 6 months in zero gravity, I mean, you can survive it. It's this what every crew on the space station endures. But frankly, since going to Mars, we're going to explore, which is a physical activity, and we want our explorers not just to survive but to be strong. I would say we have to get on with artificial gravity.
Would you go to Mars one way if you had that opportunity?
If I was going as part of a colonization effort, with a team.
You'd give it a chance,
A logistical organization behind me that would follow us up with reinforcements, more people, more equipment, more supplies, more of everything. If the plan is to take the planet, I would go. Absolutely. I mean, I don't think I'm going to have that chance. I'm getting on in years right now. But would I do it if that's what was on offer? Absolutely.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's pick it up by going to Mike in West Palm Beach, Florida, to get things started as we talk about Mars and space with Robert Zubrin. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, how you doing? I have a couple questions for your guests.
Sure.
First question is, whatever happened to the canals of Mars? For 60 years, photographs were taken of the canals. In 1962, the U.S. Air Force actually produced a map of the canals. That can be seen on the Internet. Look up the canals of Mars, 1962. Second question is, what happened to the colors of Mars? For many years, from telescopes here on Earth, they showed Mars turning green with a blue atmosphere. Can you answer those questions, please?
Thank you,
yeah,
Mike.
I will. Okay, the canals of Mars were an optical illusion that was caused by actually astronomers using telescopes with their eyes. And the eyes tended to sort of, as it were, connect the dots, and they would do hand drawings of Mars, and they would map out networks of canals, and two different people would actually see the same canals because they were doing the same connect the dots thing with their eyes. And so, and these were popularized very much by Percival Lowell, who was of a rich Massachusetts manufacturing family. The town of Lowell, Massachusetts is actually named after them, and they created an observatory, which still exists, Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. And they produced maps of Mars, and Percival Lowell wrote books saying that these were artifacts, that people were building canals on Mars, that these were a Martian civilization attempting to irrigate the planet. And this had a very strong effect on the public mind, so much so that it became assumed that there was civilization on Mars, and you got books like H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds and Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars books and so forth. And in the 1920s, there was even a prize offered for the first radio signal detected from an extraterrestrial civilization excluding Mars, because that would be too easy. But it turned out that once we actually had spacecraft that could go to Mars, which we had in the 60s, and they went and photographed it from close up, there are no canals. There are dry riverbeds on Mars. That is absolutely a fact. And we have photographs of vast networks of dry riverbeds, but there are no canals. Now, in terms of the colors, colors are tricky. When we landed Viking on Mars, and the first photographs came back, they show the sky as being blue. But once they standardized the colors against looking at the American flag that was painted on part of the spacecraft, they realized the sky was not blue, it was pink. So you have to have a standard to judge the colors against. And in other words, the guys who first got the photographs just made the sky blue because that's what the sky is here. But once they compared it to the image of the American flag on the spacecraft, they realized it was a pink sky, not a blue sky.
Next up, we have Emmy in McAllen, Texas with us. Hi, Emmy, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, Em.
How you doing, dear guest? Yes, I wanted to ask a question about, is it possible, or more clearly a question about the Van Allen radiation belt and space travel beyond low Earth orbit. And how was it possible in the Apollo mission?
Well, it's simple. We got through the Van Allen belt by going fast. That is, you don't want to put a space station in the Van Allen belt. Then the radiation would mount up and it would get you, okay? But you can whip through them, and the total dose you get is modest. And so that's how we got through it. We just zipped through. I mean, we were through the Van Allen.
Were we concerned about that, Robert?
Well, some people raised that as a concern, but they realized, they calculated the radiation dose that they would get, and it was a modest dose. I mean, in other words, if you stayed in there for days and weeks, yeah, you'd die. But if you're just whipping through it, I mean, look, it's like being exposed to a sun lamp for 1 second. You're not going to get sunburned. But you put yourself under a sun lamp for an hour, then you'll get a tan. If you put it under for 5 hours, you'll be seriously burned. So there is a question of the total dose. So, yeah, don't put your space station in the Van Allen belt. You'll die. But you can whip right through it on a fast spacecraft.
Let's go to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut, the amateur astronomer. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, George, for saying that. Thank you. Yes, hi, Robert Zuman. I am an amateur astronomer. And by the way, what you just said about the Van Allen radiation belt, which is a few hundred miles above the Earth to 1,000 miles above the Earth, at that distance from the Earth, the spacecraft, the Apollo spacecraft, were going about 25,000 miles an hour. So they did zip through it. Now, I have two quick questions for you. I'll ask them at the same time. Question number one, do you think that the first indications of life or the first data of some kind of life, most likely microbiological, microbial life on Mars, will come from a spacecraft that is already in orbit around Mars? That's the ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter, a TGO, that got to Mars last month in October, that has a methane detector that can detect specifically the methane coming from biology. In other words, it can distinguish between biological methane and geological methane. And question number two, related to Donald Trump, who I don't like. I voted for Hillary Clinton, but nevertheless, regarding the space exploration and Mars specifically, do you think it's possible, because Donald Trump talks a lot about infrastructure on planet Earth, that maybe, just maybe, just maybe, he might be for infrastructure in space in the sense that he might be the 21st century version of John F. Kennedy, in other words, for Mars, do what John F. Kennedy did for the moon with the Apollo program?
Okay. Two good questions. The first one, the answer is yes. We have detected methane on Mars. Curiosity rover detected it, and not only that, in intermittent puffs, which means the sources are localized. And that alone is very significant because it's either biogenic, as created by life, or it's created by hydrothermal systems, which are places where life could be. And so that's already, in a sense, the first indication of life on Mars. And yes, the Trace Gas Orbiter, which just got into orbit around Mars last month, has the ability to refine our understanding of these things, and it could, it could identify the methane as being biogenic, if that's what it is. Now, even if it's not biogenic, it'd be great to localize the hydrothermal vents where it is, because there could be other kinds of life in those things. Now, in terms of Trump, well, that's a big unknown, okay? I got to tell you. I mean, people see what they want to see in Trump. I think that's how he won the election, that, you know, people believe what they want to believe. I can't rule anything out. I can't rule anything in. You know, on the campaign trail during the primary and the season, he made disrespectful comments about human space exploration. But later on, when he went to Florida to campaign, he said he was all for space exploration. He does appear to want to throw a lot of money around to create jobs.
Well, this would create jobs.
Well, yeah. So that would be that. If he wants to do something that really makes a statement that America is great again, send humans to Mars. On the other hand, he does have advisors who, are not for the space program, and he has advisors, frankly, who are pro-Russian. And if we're going to defend Europe, we have to have space superiority, and they might not be in favor of that. So who knows? There seems to be quite a faction fight going on within the Trump administration right now over this choice of Secretary of State. So this could come out any which way.
I'm just amazed. We went to the moon 47 years ago with old technology. You would think we could pick up and do stuff like today without any problems at all, Bob.
Yeah, well, you know, what I like to say is that we went to the moon because in the 1960s people didn't wear bicycle helmets. We just had a different attitude towards risk. And now there are still some people, I mean, there's plenty of brave people in the world today, but they're not in government.
Yeah, they're not in government.
Controlling the government. I mean, look, the generation that went to the moon were the younger brothers of the people that won World War II. And, of course, and Kennedy actually fought in World War II. And they understood that there were things worth risking your lives for. And now people say, well, we can't go to Mars until we know it's going to be safe. Well, that's nonsense. No one ever explored new lands with the guarantee that it was going to be safe. Lewis and Clark didn't know it was going to be safe, you know, crossing the American continent.
Columbus didn't know it was going to be safe.
Yeah, Columbus didn't know. You know, if you want to do this stuff, if you want to go where people have never gone before, you can't ask for a guarantee it's going to be safe.
We go to Howard in Vancouver, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hey, Howard, go ahead.
Hello, George and Robert.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to talk to both of you again. I have a question for Robert. Back in the 1950s, Wernher von Braun designed a space station that looked like a giant wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And it rotated, and it would generate centrifugal force. And as you pointed out earlier, it would solve all of the problems of long-term exposure to zero gravity.
Right.
Now, I've often wondered why that's never been incorporated in modern space stations.
Well, that particular design would be kind of expensive, but why would artificial gravity not be incorporated? It's because the American space medicine program was taken over early by zero gravity health effects researchers, because that was the initial question, you know, involved. We're going to space. We're not going to have artificial gravity to go to the moon and back, so they wanted to know about zero gravity health effects. Could you eat and digest in zero gravity and so forth? But then as things went forward, they just basically insisted that their agenda was the agenda. So, for instance, I had an interesting interchange in the 1980s as the space station was being designed. And I asked that very question. I said, why are we designing a zero-gravity space station? And the bureaucrat responded to me saying, well, because when we go to Mars, we're going to go in zero gravity. I said, well, why are we going to go to Mars in zero gravity? He says, because all our data from the space station is going to be on zero gravity.
Made no sense. Robert, that's typical government talk for you. We're going to come back in a moment and take final phone calls with Robert Zubrin right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Robert Zubrin with us, our final segment. Robert, I want to thank you, by the way, for all the work you've done with us over the years. You have just provided this program and our listeners, which is incredible information, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. It's been great to have the opportunity to reach such a large number of people, and I really enjoy talking to your listeners.
We'll go to the phones in just a second. They continue to line up here for you. Realistically, can we get to Mars in 5 years, in your opinion?
Well, maybe.
With a person, get him there, get him back.
I think we can do it in 8.
Okay. Why the extra 3 years? Why do we need the extra 3 years?
Well, I mean, look, in principle, no. I mean, look, it only took 3.5 years to win World War II, all right? But just in terms of, okay, first of all, for it to start, there has to be a new administration, so that takes us into next year. And then just to get things going, it will take a few years. And in my plan, we land the Earth return vehicle on Mars. You can launch to Mars every 2 years, okay? So I want to land the Earth return vehicle on Mars. It makes its propellant on Mars. We have that done before the astronauts have left from Earth. So that vehicle would be launched in 6 years, and then the astronauts would be launched in 8. So, yeah, if we really poured it on, perhaps we could do it in 6 years. But my real point is this, is that if we're serious about going to Mars, if the next president is serious about going to Mars, he has to say, I want this done during my time in office.
Right.
You know, President Obama last month wrote an op-ed in CNN.com in which he said, I think we should go to Mars. Well, that's just great, him saying that, you know, like in his last 3 months in office, he says, I think we should go to Mars. It'd be a lot, would have been a lot more convincing if he had said it during his first 3 months in office back in 2009, and then said not only that we should go, but that we should be there by the end of my second term. In other words, that's what Kennedy did. Okay, now, if Trump wants to get up and play make-believe like Obama and say, I think we should go to Mars someday, or the moon, or Jupiter, or wherever, you know, in the 2030s or 2040s, then it's all make-believe. It's bullshit. But
I can't say that, Robert.
Okay, it's bunk. Baloney?
Baloney.
Yeah, baloney. Okay, but it's real if he says he's going to do it while he is on the job, not wish it for someone else to do. And that's the test. That's the test of leadership. That's the test of courage.
Why did Nixon, you know, because Kennedy was long since dead. You know, he died in 1963. We went to the moon in 69. Why did Nixon carry that on? He could have quelched it. He didn't do that. How come?
Well, he did quelch it. I mean, why didn't he quelch? Look,
quelch the moon landing.
Well, look, okay.
I mean, Apollo continued while he was president.
In December 1968, while Johnson was still president, we orbited the moon. Okay? So we were practically there.
We were in the game too much, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And as we were practically there, to kill it at that point would have just been stupid. Furthermore, he was in position to get all the credit of riding in the ticker tape parades with the astronauts when all the money had already been spent.
Right.
Okay,
right.
But what he did do, you see, was he killed NASA's plan to go to Mars, which we were supposed to go to Mars by 1981. And they had a whole plan to do it. And, I mean, look, if that plan had been followed, we would have landed on Mars in 1981. We would have had a Mars base by the late 1980s. And the first children born on Mars would be graduating high school on Mars right about now. Okay, but that was the future that he aborted. It was like Ferdinand and Isabella welcoming Columbus back from the New World and saying, oh, so what, so you discovered some continents, who cares, burn the ships, get lost, Chris. You know, that's effectively what he did. They scrapped the assembly lines. Not only that, they took the blueprints to the Saturn V moon rocket and they gave it to the Boy Scout paper drive in Huntsville, Alabama. I mean, it was insanity what they did. It was so destructive.
Okay, let's go to the phones again. It's Ed, east of the Rockies in North Carolina. Eddie, go ahead.
Hey, George, first-time caller, 20-year listener.
Thank you, Ed.
It's a pleasure to be talking with you and Robert. Robert, I have two comments to make, but I wanted to say that the comment you made about Donald Trump, I think, was a little beneath you. But let's get past that, and I'll go right to my comments.
Go ahead.
The first one is about satellites. You know, they told Ronald Reagan in 1981 that Star Wars wouldn't work because it would take $1 billion to put a weapon in space that a $150,000 weapon could come out and knock out of the air. And so it just wasn't feasible to do. But I'm telling you right now, the United States, China, and Russia all have laser-beamed satellite weapons in space, and it's just a matter of who pulls the trigger first. My second thing was about Mars. And I don't think we'll get to Mars. I mean, we can get to Mars, but I don't think we'll ever viably go back and forth from Mars for at least another 50 or 60 years.
Wow.
And And to geoengineer Mars is basically impossible until we learn how to create water. This planet that we live on is surrounded by 70% of water, and that's what it takes to create an atmosphere. And until we could take 40% of our water and put it on Mars, we'll never have a geo-engineered Mars. It's just impossible.
All right. Robert, terraforming would take how long?
Well, terraforming Mars using the kinds of technologies that we can have or can envision, say, for the next 30, 40, 50 years, that is within our current engineering horizon, would take a long time. We could make major alterations in Mars. And let me just answer a couple things. Number one, I think we should have anti-satellite weapons for the reason that I explained before, to defend our satellites and to destroy enemy satellites. But I don't think we have them, actually. I think that this has been a problem, that this has been an area of defense that has been neglected, and I hope it is corrected because this is decisive. Secondly, I think we can get to Mars within a decade in terms of people regularly going back and forth between Earth and Mars. I think the caller is more or less in the ballpark that's a few decades out. That's not 10 years from now. I mean, when the first people, it took a while before traveling the Atlantic became easy, all right? And after Columbus. Okay. Now, in terms of terraforming, though, I disagree with the caller. What you want to do is this. First thing is, now, and I believe that terraforming will only be undertaken after we have a substantial population on Mars with a substantial industrial capability at its disposal.
But obviously they're living in bubbles, right?
Yes. And they start making greenhouse gases, designer greenhouse gases like fluorocarbon gases that can really warm the planet. And if they were producing those on Mars at the same rate we're currently producing gas of that general type on Earth, which we produce them on Earth to use as refrigerants in air conditioners and refrigerators and things. If we were producing them there but not putting them in refrigerators and just releasing them into the atmosphere as greenhouse agents, we could warm the planet by 10 centigrade in 50 years. Now, that's a lot, okay? People are talking about global warming maybe warming the Earth by 1 centigrade in 100 years. So warming Mars by 10 centigrade in 50 years is much faster. And the and what that would do is cause a lot of carbon dioxide to start outgassing from the soil. And that would take maybe another 50 years to really warm the planet, another 20 or 30 centigrade, at which point the water that's frozen into the Martian soil right now would start to melt out and start to flow. So the streams of Mars will flow again, and the lakes of Mars will start filling up with water again. And you'd have a water cycle. And there'd be rain, and that would destroy the peroxides in the soil that are inimical to life. They would be destroyed, and in the process release a small amount of oxygen into the atmosphere, which is good. And the atmosphere would thicken a lot, so much so that within a century or so, it might be thick enough that we don't need a spacesuit. But we would still need breathing masks, oxygen masks. Because that would not be a breathable atmosphere. It would be mostly carbon dioxide. And now how do we turn that into oxygen? Well, we need the only way we know of today, anyway, is to use green plants, spread them around the planet, and have them start turning carbon dioxide into oxygen. And
grow trees, everything, right?
That's right. Well, you'd probably start with the simplest life forms first.
Grass?
Synthetic. Well, no, even simpler. First, photosynthetic microbes, and then lichens, and then things like grasses and such. If we talk about the kind of plants we know about today, even if we actively spread them and fertilize them and help them out, it would take like 1,000 years for them to put enough oxygen in the atmosphere for people to breathe it without a breathing mask. However, if we're talking about people doing things 100 years from now, it's really not too much to imagine that they use genetic engineering to engineer plants that are much more efficient at photosynthesis than the kind of plants we know of today. The kind of plants we know of today are only about 1% efficient at turning sunlight into biological energy and in the process releasing oxygen. What if they were 10% efficient? Then this could go 10 times faster. And so I actually believe that Mars will be terraformed 200 years from now, although perhaps not by the way I've just described it. I think people, you know, if they listen to the tape of this show 200 years from now, they'll say, wow, listen to this. Here's people in the year 2016 talking about terraforming Mars, but doing it with chemical factories and green plants. How early 21st century can you get? They had no idea we would use it with self-replicating nanorobots, okay? So that our ideas will seem interesting to them, but quaint, because we are 20th century minds grappling with a 22nd century problem. And so we're not going to have it all figured out. They will do it in better ways than we can think of today.
And briefly, his question, Ed's question about weaponization of space again, that's going to happen, if it hasn't already.
It is, but you know, if we can, if you know that who controls space will win the battle, then you don't even need to fight the battle. So we could fight the wars out by just having the satellites fight it out between themselves, and once one side establishes a space superiority, then it's checkmate, and it's time to negotiate.
There go the smartphones, right?
Yeah.
Jeez. So there's some talk that we should inhabit Titan, Saturn's moon. What do you think of that?
Well, I think we will someday. Titan's a very interesting place. It is a moon. It's got an atmospheric pressure about just a little more than the Earth's. You would not need a spacesuit on Titan. You would clearly need a breathing mask, and you need some really warm protective clothing because it's really cold. But actually, you wouldn't need a pressure suit on Titan. And not only that, on Titan, because the atmosphere is four times as thick as the Earth and the gravity is one-seventh as much, you could strap wings on your arms and fly like a bird. And the reason we live on Titan is that it's in orbit around Saturn, which has vast supplies of helium-3, which is an isotope of helium that does not exist on Earth, but it does exist in Jupiter, but it's a lot harder to get out of Jupiter's atmosphere because Jupiter has such strong gravity. Saturn has weaker gravity, and that is the ideal fuel for fusion engines, particularly for space engines using helium-3 and deuterium would be able to reach the stars.
Let's go to Bonnie in Denver, Colorado now. Good morning, Bonnie.
Good morning. Robert, it's been wonderful to hear your voice again. The last time I saw you was, I think it was 2008. I was at your office and we were celebrating the landing of the moon on the anniversary. It's wonderful to hear you still at it and everything. What I did want to ask you is, when I had gone to Case for Mars conferences in the past, one of the concerns that we always had was the focus was too strong on going to the moon, going to the moon, going to the moon, that it made it very easy to turn off the mission once we got there. And I was just wanting to hear a statement from you that's other than just going to Mars or even just going to Titan, something that keeps on an ever-going study and search and exploration of space. Do you have a good line for that?
All right, well, let me try to convey my vision. And it is good speaking to you again, Bonnie. If we go to Mars in our time, we will develop a set of hardware that will also, by the way, allow us to go to the moon and to the near-Earth asteroids. I'm not opposed to going to the moon. I'm just opposed to those people who say we can't go to Mars, so we should just go to the moon. Or we can't go to Mars until we've gone to the moon and spent a lot of time there. I think if we go to Mars, we'll be able to do some of these other things, too. We will become spacefaring. Now, once we go to Mars, once we have our first base on Mars, then there, while we don't need to go much faster than we currently go in order to do that, once we are there, then our spacecraft technology will advance by leaps and bounds. It's like Columbus crossed the ocean in ships that even 50 years later, no one would have crossed the Atlantic in. Okay, because he did it in ships that were rated for the Mediterranean, because there were no Atlantic ships in Columbus's time, because there was no transatlantic society. But once there was, then naval architecture advanced rapidly, and we went from Columbus's little boats to three-masted sailing ships, and then clipper ships, and steamboats, and ocean liners, and Boeing 747s. And that's what's going to happen. The first people that go to Mars are going to go in ships that are small and cramped and crude and slow, and their grandchildren are not going to believe that anybody ever traveled across space and things like that. And because they're going to do the trip between Earth and Mars in 3 weeks in fusion-powered spacecraft. But those same fast fusion ships that make it easy to go to Mars and back and forth will make it possible to go to Titan and the outer solar system, and for more adventurous souls. And once we establish ourselves on Titan and are getting helium-3 from Saturn, then we're going to create fusion-powered spacecraft that are going to be able to reach the stars. You know, and that's how it goes. Each step creates the driver to create the technology for the next step. You know, the Earth, you know, it was once an incredible adventure to travel across the Atlantic Ocean. I did it a week ago in a few hours, you know, watching movies while sitting in an airplane seat, okay?
Well, that's the way to do it. Robert, we are out of time. I wanted to thank you. Robert Zubrin's website, marssociety.org. Up next, a little bit of ancient wisdom. Don't touch your dial. This is Coast to Coast AM.